We're talking with Robert Gleason about Mexican slavery, not a fun subject, but it at least in part informs the new novel that he has out. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. Dead Men Don't Lie. It's part of his Outlaw Torn Slater Western series. Jackson Kane is what he writes under there. But he is also a book editor, a very well-established book editor in New York for a subsidiary of Macmillan. And we were talking about the research that went into the book, and that brings us back to this conversation about the little-known aspects of Mexican slavery, and then we'll talk about how it may or may not have lived on for as long as it did. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So, Bob Gleason, as you were just talking before the top of the hour, a little bit more about the difference between the American brand of slavery and the Mexican brand of slavery. And even when the Civil War broke out in the United States, it was over, you know, putatively under states' rights, right? That this was a states' rights issue, not about slavery. Well, it was states' right to have slavery so yeah. that they could maintain an agrarian economy that was an oligarchy and not a democracy. And it was a horrible abuse of human beings in the process. And there are people to this day who say, oh, no, nothing about slavery. It was all about states' rights. And this is what we had to, this is where I wonder too, a little bit more about the Mexican slavery piece. What was their kind of defining moment in that regard? We were talking about that before the top of the hour in a couple of different ways. So I'll leave it up to you to pick it up the way you want to.
Yeah. As mentioned before in the previous hour, that that cotton in the going up to 1860, it was the most valuable commodity in the world overall. The total value of cotton exceeded anything else. Steamship lines, all the factories in the United States, because the South had a monopoly on cotton. Which meant that the slaves themselves were fantastically valuable. So the South was never going to give up slavery. You know, that they were, from their point of view, it was the goose that laid the golden egg. You know, they were never going to give it up. And Thucydides said 2,500 years ago, in the end, all wars are fought over money. And that was really what it was fought. The Civil War was fought over the incredible financial value of those slaves. Ironically, in Mexico, the slaves had, because they were just if they worked the slaves to death or beat them to death, they'd just go and have somebody go and a slave broker go and bring them in more slaves for a nominal sum. They were enslaving the population of Mexico. They weren't buying slaves from another country.
Which is easier to do, obviously, no transportation costs, et cetera.
He has enslaved at least 50% of the country. The Mexican
crazy.
People are very, Mexican intellectuals don't know what to do with Diaz. Suppose George Washington had enslaved 50% of the white population in the
right.
United States.
Right.
You know, that would be we wouldn't know how to talk about George Washington either. There's almost no good books written about Diaz because of that. He's just too embarrassing for the Mexican intellectuals.
So fascinating.
He was Mexican. It wasn't a Spaniard or a Frenchman who was exploiting Mexico, and he exploited that country much worse than the Spaniards or the French ever did. That, among other things, he had the Industrial Revolution. He had telegraphs. He had railroads. He had all kinds of advanced weaponry. He was just, logistically, he was able to be more oppressive.
You know, this notion that we talked about in the war between the states here in the United States, it's all about money. But what was, I mean, other than the moral problem of slavery, was there a financial incentive for the North to smash slavery? I mean, you could have made the argument based on what Diaz did that if they had just found a way to skim the profits, then they might have, let the slavery go on and ever forever and ever. But they didn't, and literally, millions of people died over this war. So, what was the North's reason other than the offered moral imperative of ending slavery that inspired the government to act finally?
Well, you're right. The, fact, that's almost a never told story, that the fantastic sacrifice, the northern economy was made enormous sums of money off slavery. We had our own, you know, when the British in 1840 perfected the steam-driven spinning mill, some people, you know, stole the designs, came over here, and we replicated that. But the bankers, the factories, the shipping lines, the railroads, that cotton was simply the most valuable commodity in the United States. We had a monopoly on it. The North, during the Civil War, the northern industrialists and bankers and that lost a fortune, and the citizens from the North that were conscripted into the Union Army, they sacrificed enormously. I actually have a great 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 Uncle Joe Gleason who fought with Sherman, and he on the march to Atlanta. He got a bullet fragment in his nose, and he carried it for 20 years. These people sacrificed in blood, and of course the South had become the North hadn't really wanted a civil war, and the South was so paranoid about losing this golden goose, you know, the goose that laid the golden eggs, this cash cow. They had gotten so paranoid about their money that they declared war on the North, which was and just would not relent. And the Lincoln, those first few years of the war, he was always ready to cut a deal. And it really wasn't until the Union Navy had cut off all the rivers, it had cut off all the ports. So the cotton crops were rotting in warehouses. You know, the South was unable to sell any of its cotton. And one of the several reasons that Lincoln declared the Emancipation Proclamation was to keep the English from coming in and trying to get that cotton.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And this also when we were talking about the Catholic Church involvement, and again they were, at least in some respects, kind of in two minds. There were those within the church that insisted that this was wrong, morally wrong, that these were souls to be saved and people to be brought to Jesus. And this is the theme of the Robert De Niro, Jeremy Irons movie, The Mission, is sort of based on that, exactly on that fulcrum in history in South America. But this informs that, also, that other story about how the South had reached out to the Vatican and they were reaching out to various leaders in Europe to come save the South. And now I actually have a much better understanding of why that was. There was, you know, you can have all this cotton, or you can have essentially our white gold. You can come and take that if you come and save us. And then we'll make a deal just with you. And I thought, now I kind of get the desperation of those diplomatic moves.
Well, the irony is that the English, who milled most of the cotton, that they went and they started planting cotton in Egypt and India, and they,
right.
they owned India. It was a colony of theirs, and they controlled most of Egypt, and they started growing. So by the time the Civil War ended, the South no longer had their monopoly on cotton. And
right.
It was, ironically, they were so desperate to protect their investment, which i.e. the slaves and cotton, that they ended up losing everything. The India and Egypt became big centers for producing cotton.
Well, and that explains, of course, all the commercials for sheets and pillows made with Egyptian cotton.
Yeah.
That came out of that. But there were these weird... So how did that not happen in Mexico? Why did the parallel events with slavery in the U.S. go one direction and they went different in Mexico?
Well, Mexico was a very impoverished country, and it had been one thing, and I don't like to say anything positive about Diaz, but one thing, because his methods were so barbaric.
Right.
But the Diaz did one thing. He stabilized Mexico, and previously nobody would loan Mexico any money, and so they had a hard time, you know, building railroads, stringing telegraph wire, building any factories. I think nobody had loaned them any money. It was too, they were always, you know, oh, it was always one revolution after another, one civil war after another. But the Diaz, through horribly barbaric methods, pacified the country. And so he started getting money from most of it, really, from the from wealthy plutocrats in the United States, but also through Germany, other countries. And he did begin. They invested in the silver mines. They invested in railroads, and so there has been a tendency for historians to talk about dwell on how many miles of railroad track that Diaz laid.
Yeah.
How many locomotives? How many thousands of miles of telegraph wire he's strung, and all these tremendous industrial and agricultural advances that he made. Of course, it was all done through slave labor. But one of the things that Diaz would do in order to get this this money from these wealthy Americans and Germans was. Part of the deal was they would never have to pay any taxes in Mexico. He'd give them like 30-year leases, and he would also provide them with free slave labor.
Mm. And but in unifying the country, that explains why he's sort of a Peter the Great-like character in the history of Mexico. You know, that although also brutal, you know, a unifier and somebody who established the original boundaries, perhaps, of not just the country, but then the regions within the country, as he was sort of codifying Mexico into what we might know it today.
Well, yeah, and also that the historians, you know, history is a polemic of power.
Right.
And the historians always want to write about who won this war, who lost that war, who was the most powerful leader of that period, and that what kind of armies did this person have, that person. They don't spend that much time when you read histories of World War II, they don't spend that much time on the Holocaust. They don't spend that much time on the Gulag Archipelago, Stalin's Gulag. These are, you know, they may have a few pages here and there, but most of it is they're talking about, you know, they're talking about power.
Right. You know, we're talking here with Robert Gleason under the name Jackson Kane, has a new novel out, but it touches very profoundly on the history of Mexican slavery, something which most people, myself included, really don't understand the nuances of at all. But I know that in the U.S. there's an official end of slavery, and then in pockets all throughout the South, slavery continues just under slightly new forms, and it involves arresting people for the slightest offense and then making them work that off. But then while they can pay the VIG, but they'll never be able to pay the original debt to society. So they end up staying as essentially slaves. And then we have the penal systems, which were horribly focused on enslaving people and getting them to do public works projects for, again, in some cases, the most minor of infractions. What were the ways that unofficially slavery continued in Mexico even after its official abolishment?
Well, they had the debt, the whole, it's called debt peonage, and it's kind of a sharecropper system that in the agriculture. We had the same thing in the United States, that black sharecroppers, that they would, the people that owned the land would create the illusion somehow that these people owed them money. And they were by law, they weren't allowed to leave the farm until they paid off their debt. So they were essentially enslaved. And also they could, you know, they could sell you to another farmer. It really
in Mexico?
No, in the United States.
Right.
And they had something similar down in Mexico too, but they could. This debt peonage, which we called the sharecropper system in the United States, you know when it finally ended? That in the late 40s, that the Alice Chalmers and the other they invented the mechanized cotton picker, and and suddenly overnight. He didn't need people to pick cotton anymore, and that was the only way that this debt peonage, the sharecropper, the kind of sharecropper. We still have sharecroppers, but they're not essentially owned body and soul by the people that own the farms that they work.
I have some of that in my family history. That very clear part of my family history in the South, my original ancestors came over in the early 18th century, and they were indentured servants. They had to pay off the passage to come here. But whereas they, and this is true within my family, it's verified, one ship landed in the wrong port, they disembarked, and so they were then put to work at a place, I can't remember if it was Maryland or Delaware or something like that, and then they had to work their, then they got down to Virginia and they had to pay off the original debt that they had. So they ended up working 14 years in indentured servitude, and they couldn't get out of it.
That's terrible. My grandfather, my mother's father was an indentured copper miner for the Anaconda Copper Company in Butte, Montana. We have something in common, Ian.
Yeah. So then, even though we know, it's funny because as we talk about this, perhaps people who've seen the movie In the Still of the Night knows that this is, you know, arresting a, in this case, even a black Philadelphia detective standing on a platform waiting for a train for loitering. That loitering became like, you know, if you were standing around for too long, you could be arrested. That was still a legacy of American slavery, that they would find a way to put people in these systems and they would grind them under for years before they could get out. And maybe perhaps, as you point out, in the mines of in Mexico, never heard from again. Is there anything about the Mexican slavery system that you see manifested in, and I know this is like a, I'm going in left field, but I'm curious, in the brutality of the Mexican drug wars and the cartels, is there anything that you think comes as a result of that original DNA?
The thing that the Spaniards brought to Mexico and also to most of Latin America that was arguably, it was, I'm not saying it was worse than slavery, but the effects were far more long-lasting and extremely pernicious. If you were a Spaniard and you wanted to come to the New World and you wanted to, you know, make a lot of money, and you didn't want to spend more than a couple of years, 5 years maximum in the New World, because you were afraid of malaria and yellow fever and other diseases, the indigenous diseases. And so that you would come and you'd want to make as much money as possible. Among other things, you'd have to pay the king of Spain a lot of money in order to get your job, say you're governor of Mexico or whatever. That these high level jobs that where you had the potential to make money, you had to pay the king, and so you had to somehow pay off that investment. Now, the king didn't pay anything. That you came here and you exploited the population, and so you gouged anybody that wanted anything had to pay, and it went all the way down to the lowest officials who'd kick money upstairs to higher up. A system called the Mordida. It was a system of bribery.
The Mordida, we're gonna pause right there, and we'll come back to that as it relates to my question. And then I do want to ask you a little bit more about your books on terrorism, your novels on terrorism, at a pivotal time in our history next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking about Mexican slavery as it's just the backdrop and then part of an essential understanding in the plot of this new novel, which is out by Jackson Kane, otherwise known as Bob Gleason, Dead Men Don't Lie, an outlaw Torn Slater Western. And it just, you know, it's the amount of research that he does and the stories that he tells, even before we get to the fictional works that come out of it, still great stories. And we were just talking about the Morditas. We'll get back to that in a moment on Coast to Coast AMs. We'll get to your calls coming up next hour for Robert Gleason as we wrap up our conversation with me next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Robert Gleason, we were talking about Morditas. And just in case people were tuning in between now and when you brought it up before, explain what that is. Robert?
Yes, hi.
Hi, sorry. So the Morditas, you were just getting into that, and in case somebody didn't catch our little bit before, explain what that is.
I just want to say one thing real quickly, though. This is not the Dead Men Don't Lie by Jackson Kane. It's not a tome about Mexican slavery, though there is significant slavery in it. It's a historical thriller. We've got great reviews, and it features a spectacularly beautiful, powerful, wealthy femme fatale who rules half of Mexico, and she has one really another unfortunate characteristic that she's sexually sadistic. And her legions of lovers, their fate, this does not bode well for her lovers. A young American is wandering through Mexico, and he falls into her web, and she's initially attracted to him. But again, this is not going to end well. And so his mother and the most notorious desperado in all the American West go down to Mexico to rescue him and get caught up in a Mexican Revolution and slave labor silver mines. And so there's lots of excitement and adventure. And as I said, it got terrific reviews.
No doubt.
About the Mordida, getting back to the Mordida. It was the most long-lasting affliction that the Spaniards really visited on any of their colonies in the New World was that it was a system of bribery that people had to pay the king of Spain to get their positions. They would go down there because they were afraid of catching malaria and yellow fever. They did not want to stay forever, and they just wanted to go wring as much money as they could out of the population, and then go back to Spain and get a villa and live a life of ease for the rest of their lives. And they were absolutely ruthless in extorting money from people, and it's called the Mordida. It's a system of bribery. And one thing, the Spaniards killed a lot of Mexicans. They enslaved them. They did a lot of bad things. But the one thing they brought in that the Mexican people have had just hell's own time trying to get over is the Mordida. And there even today that cops will pull people over in Mexico City and just extort money from drivers for no reason at all. And that kind of, Russia has the same problem. They call it the blot. In the Mideast, they call it the backsheesh. And once that kind of disease infects a country, it's something, it really holds the country back. It's brutal to try to overcome that. People don't trust each other.
And that, if I'm tying it back to the original question, this is then this is the legacy. This is the blueprint for the cartels and how they still operate to this day. And how it is really that this type of nefarious patronage worked in New York, for that matter. That the mafia came in from the hills of Sicily and they did the same sort of thing. And every ethnic group, it would seemingly, has its own mafia in that way. But this the brutality of the Mexican cartels, that all of the beheadings and all of that, the things they've done to nuns and priests, and it just is so seemingly just so over the top in Mexico, and I don't want to say like you can't go to Mexico or whatever, but sure. Man, if you read just the headlines, it's a terrifying place to visit.
Well, the Spaniards brought with them the code of machismo, but to some extent, by pure coincidence, the slave owners in the United States, the plantation owners, had a similar code. The Spartans, which had a huge slave society, there's nothing more macho than the Spartans. And also when the Spaniards came over and they brought this, they respected and admired skill with weapons, skill horsemanship. They raped women en masse when they came over here. They were the ultimate machos. But when they did come over, the Mexican people, they had the Maya Aztec religion, and it was a religion. It was a death cult. It worshipped death. When you went to the afterlife, if you died, an Aztec or a Maya Indio, the people, it was a horrible afterlife. There's like 9 levels, and if you made it to the 9th level, you got oblivion. You just disappeared, which was the only thing you could hope for. But in the afterlife, the two classes of people that were treated the best were the noble warriors and the suicides. If you killed yourself, you had the exact same status as a warrior. That they believed that life was inconsolable sorrow, it was a veil of tears, and that the gods hated us and despised us, which is why they had to do all these blood offerings to the of human blood offerings to the gods to propitiate them, and that you're just better off dead, and this blended. It blended into the Spanish machismo in an odd kind of way, and it was the notion that you should never fear death, that death is your wisest advisor, death is a gift, and that a real man would allow himself to be killed before he would dishonor himself, and it really is the Mexican machismo ends up it's not like. You know, machismo that is as it's generally known in the United States, it's almost a love affair with death.
Right.
And you're right. I mean, you can see that most obviously in among the drug cartels. However, there is another side though to that, and the Mexican people have tremendous courage and perseverance, and that's the positive side of this, that they really. There's a fearlessness to them that you can see that the New York Times did a piece about these people coming up from southern Mexico, Guatemala, trying to make it to the United States and get across the border. And what they go through, danger, the violence, they go trying to make their way to the United States. These are young kids. They're tremendously courageous. I mean, they are willing to risk things that no young people in the United States would risk for anything.
You know, this will get branded as though it is political, but I just think it's phenomenological. Having lived in many agricultural-based states, having lived for quite a while in Arizona, but now living now in Kansas, this is something I hear a lot, and that this is one of the great fears of COVID. Too was COVID-19 was that there wouldn't be anybody left to pull the crop out of the field, and that with all of the people can speak very glibly about shutting this down or building a wall or doing whatever, but there are whole parts of our economy that are based on the people who are coming in at their own great self-sacrifice to try to earn this money, then to take it back and then come back again in the next season. And, you know, we do hear the salacious stories about somebody who is a criminal or somebody who is a psychopath or whatever, but the effort that it takes to get here and the amount of money that they make while they're here, it's not enormous, but it's you know, sustaining. Meanwhile, if they're not here, there aren't local kids who are going to go out and do these jobs. The day that this is where you really do get into a concern about things rotting in the field if you don't have enough people to pull the harvest. And I think those are the times when I respect the positive impact in our economy, and we've yet to work out a solution on all of that, and I'm not proposing one now, but it recognizes just what you said, that this resilience to go do the work and then go back home again, and then come back and go through all of that again. I think that takes a lot of character, especially when the people who are nearby don't want to do that work.
Yeah, well, one of the little underappreciated aspects of immigration. You know, school teachers complain about this a lot. How do you instill motivation into a student? How do you get people to have that fire in the belly that want to work hard, to do things? You know, it's a mystery.
Right.
Nobody knows how, knows how that works. Some people are just tremendously motivated. Most people aren't. They really, and you know, that if you were really dumb and lazy, you'd stay back in your native land and be dumb and lazy. That these people that come, that cross oceans and continents and that, to come to the United States because they want to work. you know, and they want to do something with their lives. These people are really the best of the best. They, in terms of just sheer motivation, and they have the fire in the belly, the hunger to go do something.
To be upwardly mobile.
Yeah, yeah, and they really do. And it's a kind of a natural selection, really. That it's as if the best of the brightest, the most motivated, said, "I'm going to get the hell out of here and go someplace else where I can be more successful."
Yeah, I've always said I've known many people who I thought were much more talented than I am, but they didn't have a quarter of the ambition that I have. And that's what makes the difference. And I see their work and I think, oh, that's so good, dude. And then that's it. I'm the only one who saw that work. And they just didn't want to do the heavy lifting to get it to the next level.
And courage too. It's not only motivation. These people, it takes a lot of guts to pack up and go into the great unknown and, you know, brave the seven seas and whatever, and go without very much money. Go, you know, and just you know, trust to your lucky star and your ability to work hard.
And the willingness to be humiliated, which I've realized was a gift that I had. I don't fear failure in that way, and I fail a lot. I mean, wherever there are people who are not reading books, I wrote those books. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't sell a lot of the books that I publish, and I love the books I work on, and I do it because I love it. But that's where I find myself still being drawn. I'd rather do that work and hope that 20 years from now someone will pick up that book and go, oh, here's an idea, than to let it sit around in my brain forever and do nothing.
You're casting bread upon the waters.
Yeah, trying to. But, all right, so while I have this before we get to the phones, let me ask you about something else, Robert Gleason, if I can. You look at world events, and you I've seen the clips of your appearances on things like Fox Business News, and I know that you see a bigger picture maybe than many of us do. So what are you seeing in the events of the last couple of weeks, and what are your concerns about this country as somebody who's written about terrorism and about insurrection? Where are you with where we are positioned as a nation these days?
Well, you know, there's a revolution going on in the United States, and it's something nobody ever really talks about. They had, you know, it has been pointed out that this recession, depression that we're going through, it's verging on a genuine, for at least 25% of the country, it's a depression. And it's been pointed out, you know, people wonder, well, why is the stock market, you know, thriving in the midst of all this? And it turns out that there's a number of fantastically powerful and wealthy companies, the six big giant tech firms, the big tech, but there's also some big investment banks and stuff, that they seem to be just to transcend the economy. They float above the economy. And what has happened is, and it's been accelerated by the pandemic, that we got back in the early 80s, we essentially got rid of the antitrust laws, and we changed the whole definition of antitrust. And so that basically companies could merge, and the mergers are very expensive, and they don't make any sense really economically, most of them. But they do liquidate the competition, and so that you end up with these monopolies and oligopolies, and of course the pandemic has killed off God knows how many tens of thousands of small businesses, and the people that are the companies that are surviving the best are these gigantic companies. Well, the big problem with that is, as Louis Brandeis said a long time ago, you know, that you can have wealth and of power concentrating in a few hands, or you can have democracy. You cannot have both, and that's the real revolution. And the revolutionaries are the super rich, the mega rich, and these big mega rich firms and the CEOs. And they will eventually, you know, we'll wake up one day and we really won't have a democracy anymore. It's ironic that a lot of the people talk about how big government is the enemy. They're so naive about these gigantic, you know, oligopolies and these gigantic monopolies. And the irony is, the only entity that's big enough to rein them in and take our freedom back. It's really the government.
How do you feel about the breakup then of Amazon, or the breakup of some of these other companies, these other tech companies, which, you know, they grew at a time when there was a lot of competition, and now they're at the top of the pile for their particular sector.
I'm a little confused by Amazon. I can't really. I do think Facebook is a real problem. I mean, you know, another thing people don't talk about is there's a child rape pandemic going on in the United States. You see it online. The New York Times had a big thing came out a couple of years ago that in 2008 it was predicted, believe it or not, Joe Biden and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the congresswoman from Miami, they predicted that there was a child rape pandemic that was growing, and it was being evidenced online. And they actually passed an anti-child rape, online anti-child rape video bill. And back then, it was the number of images and videos online that was several hundred thousand, but they said this is going to increase. Well, guess what? Guess how many images and videos of child rape porn we have online right now?
Stop. That's perfect. We'll pick it up right there. I don't want to make this kind of a dark tease, but we run out of time, and we'll get to that next hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.